cities, indigenous tribes, and countries around the world have given nature and specific natural resources legal rights, or the rights of personhood. That has some environmentalists cheering and opponents of expanding legal rights in that way seeing red. But what does it even mean to have legal rights if you're a river or a forest or the air? Craig Kaufman is Associate Professor of Political Science and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon. He's also a member of the United Nations Knowledge Network on Harmony with Nature. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what does it mean to give natural resources legal rights or rights of personhood?
Well, first, I want to just clarify that the rights are typically given to ecosystems. And so it may seem like a small change in verbiage, but it's actually important conceptually, and it's important to understand for understanding why people might care about this. That is to say, in the philosophy underlying the law, the elements that receive rights are not just seen as individual stocks of resources, but rather are complex nested living ecosystems whose parts are all interconnected in ways that humans don't fully comprehend, but that humans are dependent on these ecosystems like ocean ecosystems, river ecosystems, lake ecosystems, forests, for everything that we need for life, from clean air, water, to food.
So, for instance, if a river, like, for instance, I know that there is a very significant river in New Zealand that has been given this kind of designation. It's not just the river, i.e. the water. It's everything that relies on it.
Correct. Yeah, it's the watershed is the parlance that scientists would use, right? So it's not just the water. It's all of the living elements that live in the watershed, which is a geographic area from where the water collects to where it flows out to the ocean. And that's seen as a single living entity. And we can talk about the specific right. Different laws will recognize different rights. And so that's one of the things that's interesting to look at is the variation of the rights that are recognized and the impacts of that. So I don't know if you want to go into that now or.
Yeah, let's talk about what it means in reality if, as you said, ecosystem is granted some kind of rights. How are those rights expressed or used?
Yeah, there's really two kind of models. So what's interesting about this is the rights of nature phenomenon is the result of simultaneous separate grassroots movements that have emerged around the world, responding to common pressures, but because they're experimenting in their own, national cultures and political and economic systems, the rights get expressed somewhat differently in different places. So in some places like Ecuador or the United States, there's really three main sort of fundamental rights. One is just the right to exist. That is to say, it has the right not to be destroyed. A second is that it has the right to continue existing, that is to say, to maintain its natural cycles that allow it to function. So, for example, watersheds would have the right to continue producing water. And then the right to be restored if damaged. And the last one is important because it doesn't mean that that humans can't impact the land. It just means that if humans do impact the land, that to the point where the ability of the ecosystem to function and exist may be threatened, that humans have the responsibility of restoring the ecosystem to a point where it can survive and function naturally. Those are the most common rights expressed.
And what happens, for instance, if the rights of an ecosystem, as you said, are violated? If someone violates my rights in some way, one of the ways that I can look for a redress is to take them to court. How would a river, for instance, file a complaint against someone?
Yeah, so really what you're asking is who speaks for the river?
Exactly.
Right? And so, there are different. It's been set up different ways in different countries. We think of different guardianship mechanisms. But again, there's kind of two models. So one model that's been used in Ecuador is to say that anybody has the ability to speak on behalf of the river if they see that its rights are being violated. So essentially they're removing you know, or they're removing restrictions to legal standing. But nobody is obliged then under that system to speak for the river. So you're just hoping that people will step up. A different model, which was used in New Zealand and some other places, is to appoint specific guardians who not only have the authority to speak or represent the interests and advocate for the interests of the ecosystem, whether it's a forest or a river, but have the obligation to do so. And they have the obligation to do so not just in court after the fact, after damage has been done, but to do so preemptively. That is to say, for example, have a seat at the table in decision-making policy forums where land management or land use decisions are being made so that the rights of the ecosystem can be taken into consideration up front, so that you can hopefully prevent the violations that would require you to go to court. And so the first system is more reactive, legalistic model, if you will, and the second one is less legalistic and more proactive in just incorporating rights of nature into the original decision-making body. And doesn't really, the hope is that you wouldn't have to go to courts then.
We're talking with Craig Kaufman right now. He's Associate Professor of Political Science and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon. We're talking about the growing trend of providing legal rights to natural resources. And Craig, how long has this concept been around?
The concept's been around for ages. So in many non-Western societies, it goes back centuries, if not millennia. But even in Western cultures, it goes back at least to the 60s and 70s. Right. So in the United States, in 1972, a lawyer named Christopher Stone wrote a now fairly famous book, Should Trees Have Legal Standing? And it was written in response to a lawsuit where the Sierra Club was suing the Disney Corporation to try to prevent the building of a Disney resort in a high mountain valley. And the problem, the court was sympathetic to the arguments of the Sierra Club, but the problem was the court said the Sierra Club didn't have standing because the Sierra Club wasn't itself harmed. And a lot of lawyers, and including Supreme Court Justice Douglas at the time, because this went all the way to the Supreme Court, argued that that was unsatisfactory, that there are a lot of parts of the world that are important for their own sake, but including for humans, but that if they've got damaged, it would be hard to show that any particular person was directly harmed. And so that was seen as a hole in the legal code that needed to be fixed. And so you start to have lawyers and judges thinking about maybe we should give legal standing to ecosystems.
At first glance, it might seem that this is new legal ground, but legal rights that are equivalent to that of people have been granted to other non-human entities already, right?
Sure. No, absolutely. So our legal system already grants legal personhood status and rights. We treat all kinds of non-living, non-human things as if they were people legally, corporations, trusts, estates, marine vessels and ships and so forth. So the idea that we would, you know, grant legal personhood status and rights to a non-living entity really isn't radical. I mean, that exists all the time. The question is, you know, do we value ecosystems that provide clean air, clean water, food, other things that we need for life as much as we value, say, corporations and their property rights?
Can you give us some specific examples, especially here in the U.S., I think, so that we might be able to relate to it a little more easily, of places or groups who have pursued this on behalf mm-hmm. of natural resources?
Yeah. So again, I want to keep emphasizing it's not natural resources, right? Because the logic is we want to get away from thinking of nature as just a set of independent stocks of resources that if you just use one, it's going to have no effect on the system. And that, of course, just isn't true any more than the human body is just a collection of biological resources, right? There are systems where if I took away my heart, that would have important effects for the rest of the system. Mm-hmm. So the same thing goes with the ecosystem. So in the United States, there are now 47 communities around the country that have adopted municipal ordinances recognizing rights of nature. And a common story is this. What's interesting to me about the U.S. phenomenon is that it's not being propelled by environmentalists principally. And the Toledo Lake Erie example is a good example of this. A common scenario is that, you know, increasingly pressures on the ecosystem from industrial extraction and other things is just getting to the point where it's really negatively affecting the health of families. And just concerned parents are realizing that they need to do something. And so their initial response is to just assume that, hey, if an outside a fracking company, for example, that engages in hydraulic fracturing, comes in and injects the fracking wastewater into the only drinking water system and spoils the only available drinking water, a lot of local communities assume that they should be able to have a say in whether or not their drinking source, drinking water source, is destroyed or not. And then they are quickly surprised to learn that the law doesn't actually give them any rights to protect their families. And so they are coming to the realization that the existing environmental laws and existing human rights laws have proven inadequate to protect communities and families from the kind of environmental degradation that's starting to affect the health and well-being of their families. And so increasingly, many communities are coming to the conclusion that they just need to start changing laws. Recognizing rights of nature isn't the only way that you could fix laws. It's just one that's common. And I could give you some rationale. Do we have time to get into the rationale for why communities, sure, why rights of nature can help boost community rights?
Absolutely.
Because in the United States, this is an important point. The rights of nature laws in the United States are being propelled by community rights activists, because the common scenario is that, you know, if a community finds that diseases or, you know, incidences of cancer or access to drinking water or, you know, other problems are skyrocketing as a result of injection of sewage sludge or hydraulic fracturing waste or what have you, and they go to court and say, hey, we've been harmed, we want to try to prevent this harmful behavior, it's really difficult for them to get legal standing to be able to protect themselves in court. Because the burden of proof to show that you were that there was a direct link from the industrial activity that caused the environmental degradation was specifically responsible for, say, your husband's cancer or your child's, you know, disease or what have you. And so legally, it's very difficult to protect yourself. And of course, the law doesn't really protect or recognize community rights. It just protects corporate rights, property rights. And so the advantage of structuring these around rights of nature is that if you recognize an ecosystem that you depend on as a legal person with rights, much like you would recognize a corporation as a legal person with rights, and then you establish the community as the guardians who have the ability to speak on behalf of the ecosystem, it's quite easy scientifically to show a direct link between an industrial activity and a degradation of the functioning of an ecosystem. And then the community can better protect its rights by virtue of being the guardian for the ecosystem. And so because of this, what's interesting to me is there are a number of cases in the United States where these rights of nature laws are occurring in states that are red states, you know, that are not by communities that don't particularly consider themselves environmentalists. They're just trying to protect their communities.
We're talking about the movement to grant legal rights to nature. Craig Kaufman is Associate Professor of Political Science and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon. He's also a member of the United Nations Knowledge Network on Harmony with Nature. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these efforts? Do you think that nature needs to be protected in this way? Or do you think that it's a bad approach that could have significant drawbacks? If you're in favor of it, is there an aspect of nature or an ecosystem that you would like to see given this protection? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about movements to give nature legal rights or personhood under the law. It's been put in place in a variety of cities, countries, and Native nations. Craig Kaufman is with us. He's an associate professor of political science and environmental studies at the University of Oregon. He's also a member of the United Nations Knowledge Network on Harmony with Nature. And Craig, is this approach, this trend, seen as a tactic tied to concerns about, for instance, global warming and other large-scale natural crises?
Absolutely. In fact, I'd say there's really this movement is being pushed both by the bottom up, by grass movements of communities around the world who, as I said before, are just looking for new pathways to deal with the intensified pressures on the environment that affects their health and well-being of their families. But at the same time, it's being propelled from the top down by policymakers and governments who recognize that we have a closing window of opportunity to deal with a number of environmental crises, both climate change as well as extensive biodiversity loss, and that we need radical system change to do that. So your listeners may remember that just last March, I believe it was, the United Nations Scientific Panel charged with studying the science of biodiversity issued a report warning that human actions was causing essentially a sixth mass extinction, extensive loss of species around the world, as many as 1 million species. And that, you know, just a few months earlier than that, the Scientific Panel on Climate Change, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released its report showing that the worst effects of climate change we'll start to see as early as 2040, right? So this isn't decades away. This is, you know, certainly in our lifetimes. So the science is quite clear. The current economic system, the current legal and governance systems are just unsustainable in the very literal sense of being able to unsustain the functioning of the ecosystems that we depend on for survival. And it's not too late to take action, but the window of opportunity is closing, and we're going to need dramatic transformation in our systems. And so the idea behind Rights of Nature, it's just one strategy for how you would structure legally a new kind of legal and governance systems that makes human activity consistent with the laws of nature, that is to say, the laws of how natural ecosystems actually function.
Let's go to the phones, and Pat in Duluth, Minnesota is there. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I had not heard of this idea before, but I totally love that on many levels. But a practical one right now that I'm experiencing in Duluth, there's a green corridor that goes down towards Lake Superior, and it has been developed in the past, parts of it. It is somewhat fragmented, but not a lot. But there's a golf course now that the city doesn't want to support, and none of the elected officials are talking about anything other than development. And I look around and I see the scientific papers from all over the world, really, that are talking about climate change and the need to save the green space, to replant trees. And I just think how backward thinking we are, just giving it away to the development process.
Thank you so much for that call, Pat. And Craig, we're running a little short on time. I wanted to ask you if there has been opposition or challenges to these types of conditions giving nature legal rights.
Absolutely, of course. Anytime you're talking about changes in, again, the end goal is not to have the rights per se. The end goal is to prevent human activities that are going to destroy the ecosystems on which human life depends, right? And so there are, of course, organizations and individuals that benefit from the status quo, and they're fiercely resisting.
And have they been successful in challenging it, for instance, in court?
Certainly. Well, so in the United States, in the United States, it's early. This is kind of getting into the weeds a bit because we have a federal system, because not a lot of legislation happens through the national legislature. That's why this is happening in piecemeal fashion at the grassroots through municipal ordinances. It takes a while for this jurisprudence to develop because it's based on a different philosophy of law than most lawyers and judges are trained in. And so in Ecuador, for example, Ecuador is a good example because it was the first to make a really strong law, put it in the Constitution. And it took several years for judges to fully understand how to interpret the constitutional provisions. But now that it's been a decade past, we've seen judges learn how to do that, and they have been interpreting it in a way that I think more effectively balances property rights and the rights of nature.
And Craig, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us. Craig Kaufman is Associate Professor of Political Science and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon. He was with us to talk about the trend of giving nature legal rights.